Hey, welcome. I'm Chris Lopez, host of the Valley Pod, where we talk to all the interesting people of the San Luis Valley. Joining us today in our studio on the south side of Alamosa is Colorado State Senator Barb Kirkmeyer. She's on the campaign trail here in the San Luis Valley as a candidate for the Republican nomination for governor in 2026. Here in the Centennial State. Senator, thank you for giving us some of your time. It's great to meet you.
Well, it's wonderful to meet you and hear about the Valley, and thank you for having me.
Yeah, let's start, you know, Colorado turns 150 years in 2026. So let's start there, and I want to just ask you or have you give us your view of the state 150 years into the statehood, your vision for the state as a gubernatorial candidate, 150 years.
So 150 years. Wow. Yeah. You know, I used to be the president of the South Platte Valley Historical Society.
Very cool.
It's one of the first where it's built around a fort, Fort Lupton, actually. It was a trading fort. So know a lot of history about the state of Colorado, and we have come a long way. But, you know, unfortunately, in the last 7 years, our state is just kind of a mess right now. We're unaffordable, we're unsafe, and quite frankly, we're just kind of unraveling in a lot of different areas. So for me, and the reason I'm running for governor is, you know, I'm a fourth generation Coloradoan, and this is my state, and I want to run to make a difference because it matters. It matters that, you know, as elected officials, we're supposed to leave the state off in a better place. We're supposed to be looking out into the future and deciding how do we help people that so they can improve their lives, you know, and improve the quality of their life, that type of thing, and enhance it. So hopefully we can get there, but right now it's just there's just so many things that we need to work on, just so much that is, you know, from one party control that we've had in this state that just really is failing. I mean, there are times I feel bad because it's like I hate going around being such a downer about it. But I do think that there is an opportunity for us to have our brighter days ahead of us instead of way behind us kind of thing. And, you know, I want to be the governor of a state and go work for a state where we have access to good health care, where our insurance rates, you know, we've worked to figure out how to get our insurance rates lower, and we feel safe in our communities, and we protect our kids, and we have an education system that is full of opportunity for children, and that, you know, teachers teach and parents parent, but let's remember what the education system's supposed to do. And then we've got to get to where we're cutting all this red tape and these overburdensome regulations that are on our businesses and almost every industry in this state where, you know, they just can't thrive. So I want a state where, you know, we have a robust economy and people feel good about themselves and they know that there is opportunity abound for them. That's the state of Colorado I'm going to go fight for, and that's why I'm running for governor.
Well, you have quite the resume when I look at your background politically, but before we go there, we're going to get a little bit more into each of those issues that you talked about and a few others. Yeah. But before we go there, let me just ask you about your trip here into the Valley and what you're up to or what you're doing or who you're seeing or what you're hearing as you make the, I'm assuming you're here crossing the state, learning, meeting people, et cetera, as in your part of your governor candidate.
Well, I would say, first of all, this is one of my favorite parts of the state. And I'm not just saying that because I'm here. I was actually, at one point, I was the executive director of the Department of Local Affairs and served on Governor Bill Owens' cabinet, had the opportunity to not only travel the state, but provide grants and work with local governments and nonprofit organizations, again, to help them better their community and meet the needs of the community that they define, not necessarily that I would define. So I spent a lot of time in the Valley because, and being a former county commissioner, I knew a lot of the county commissioners and a lot of mayors and, you know, folks that were in local government. And so we did a lot of really great things here in the Valley, you know, improving healthcare and getting, I can still remember Commissioner Darius Allen calling me up when I was at the Department of Local Affairs saying, hey, you know, hey, Kirkmeyer, we need this. We need this MRI and we need this in our hospital. And we figured out how to get it. So I am out traveling the state because I am campaigning for governor of the state of Colorado and getting out to some, you know, there are a lot of favorite spots.
Right.
I mean, we have a beautiful state. You know, it almost doesn't matter where you go, but we've got a really beautiful state to travel. So that's been fun. And I told somebody when I was starting this campaign, they're like, wow, it's going to be a lot of work. And I said, are you kidding? I'm going to feel like I'm on vacation. I get to go travel the state and talk to lots of great people and find out, you know, their perspective of Colorado and what's going on for them in their community. But I'm down here because I'm going to meet with the San Luis Valley Republican women. They're having their Christmas party and I'm going to go speak to them. That's early early, I think that's around noon or so.
Tell Cheryl O'Dowd we said hello you see her.
Yeah, I will. And so I'm going to go to that with Senator Simpson's wife, Kathy. And I think that'll be fun. And it'll be great just to talk to folks again. And then tonight we're having like a meet and greet kind of situation where folks can come and meet with us and meet with me and talk with me and ask me questions and tell me what's what, you know, kind of thing.
As you go around the state, and you don't even have to as a candidate for governor, because you know this state, mm-hmm. because of the, you talked about your time as county commissioner, but in the state legislature, in the Senate, you worked for governor. You know Colorado, I would assume, after all this work. So let me ask you, do you see disparities in parts of Colorado that need addressed versus other parts of Colorado? As you go county to county, you go into the eastern part of Colorado, the West Slope here in the Valley, do you see differences, disparities, or are we all still kind of in the same boat here?
Oh, I see disparities. I see, you know, and I have talked about this before, and you know, again, I grew up in rural Colorado. I still live in rural Colorado, in Weld County, which is a huge agricultural county. And the divide between rural and urban has kind of widened, especially over the course of the last 7 years. But here's what greatly concerns me. I sit on the Joint Budget Committee. So I'm one of six members of the General Assembly that literally we write the budget for the state of Colorado. And I think something that's not getting as much as tension as it should be getting, at least from those of us that are under that golden bubble, you know, they call the capital, is access to healthcare. And we have 25 counties in the state that have no maternal healthcare. That means every woman in those counties doesn't have any place to go for maternal healthcare. I just think that's appalling. And those areas are all in rural Colorado, you know, in areas like even down here or, you know, in the lower Arkansas Valley or on the western slope or up in the eastern side of our state as well, where hospitals are closing their maternal healthcare because it's too expensive and because continual cuts to Medicaid provider rates, which are reimbursements to, you know, for medical care, for hospitals, for doctors, for behavioral health care, clinics, all of those types of things. And we've continued to cut those. And as a member of the Joint Budget Committee, I mean, that is like my number one priority to make sure that we fund. And, you know, I have been working very diligently to ensure that we do fund those areas, But just recently, the governor cut $500 million, over $500 million, half a billion dollars, out of Medicaid reimbursements.
And yeah, we want to talk lot more about Medicaid, because that's a topic that you hear a lot about, but I personally don't grasp.
Yeah.
But I do want to.
But it's jeopardizing. We're jeopardizing our own healthcare access in the state for all Coloradoans, but it's really hitting rural Colorado hard. And then here's one other area, Chris, that I think is extremely important as well that I've been fighting for. And I'm going to tell you, you've got a great champion in Senator Cleve Simpson. He's great at telling us what's going on in his neck of the woods.
He was a good basketball player in high school.
I'll bet he was as tall as he is. higher education. You know, you've got a higher education institution here, and it's remarkable. I mean, it's like a anchor for this community, and it is so important to the community. And yet, time over time, I've seen it on the Joint Budget Committee where it's just not getting funded the way it needs to be funded. So 2 years ago, I was able to get some additional money, and it was $3 million. It was for Fort Lewis, for Adams State, and for Western State, so that they could have some additional dollars because they just needed it. And you know, it's like I told the then president, I can't remember the name right now, the president for Adams State, but it's
Tanberg.
Thank you. That's right. I can see his face. I just couldn't remember his
David
name.
David Tanberg, yeah.
He's great. And he comes in front of the Joint Budget Committee and presents, you know, about Adams State and how important it is. And I've come down and toured the campus as well. And the thing is what I told him is, you know, I live in rural Colorado still, and my kids went to school in Fort Lupton, which is a small rural community. And they're not looking to go to the University of Colorado necessarily, or, you know, even Colorado State University. I mean, you know, those are great universities and they should go, but they're looking for that smaller university that meets their needs, that they can feel comfortable in. And that's what our rural institutions provide. There's that, and then they provide so much for the economy. So I think we need to make sure that we don't lose that in rural Colorado as well.
You know, I appreciate everything you said and the advocacy for rural Colorado. I appreciate that. I'm from Alamos. I live in rural Colorado, right? And I appreciate your advocacy for rural Colorado. But let me ask you, because I think this is where I get confused when I think of state government and state spending. Rural Colorado doesn't have populations. The San Luis Valley, we don't have net gains in population. Alamosa County does, but it's one of the few counties in the six-county valley where you see more births than deaths and you see a little population at least holding its own. Every other little place around here continues to shrink. Mm-hmm. Same on the eastern plains. I have friends that live in Lahana, Lamar, Rocky Fort, Swink, Fowler. They had their day, thankfully. But in reality, these are small towns that just don't have much to them when it comes to a population and continue to bleed populations. Where we see Colorado growing population-wise is that Front Range. Mm-hmm. Weld County, Larimer County, Western Slope, Mesa County, Grand Junction. You see it in La Plata, Durango, healthy community. So I guess I wonder from a policy perspective is why should we in the Valley have 12 school districts? Do we really need them? You see what I'm saying? I'm like, we keep shrinking and should we? I don't know what that future is here. And I don't know if I'm making sense in what I'm trying to ask here. But I just wonder about our own, when I think of Colorado as a whole.
Yeah. Well, and we need to, from the state, have a larger vision. Like, and you know, I tell people all the time, when I'm governor, I'm going to be a governor for everybody in the state. But we've got to help our smaller communities. And let's remember, agriculture is a $47 billion industry in this state. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Valley and those other areas you mentioned are pretty darn important to agriculture in our state. So they're very important to the overall well-being of the state of Colorado. I mean, we are feeding the world from Colorado, right? And then we have a lot of energy industry as well. Even, you know, in this neck of the woods, whether it's, mm-hmm. you know, La Plata County or Montezuma County or, you know, Weld County. I mean, and most of that energy industry is in more of our rural parts of the state. And again, that's one of our top economic, you know, drivers here in the state of Colorado. So here we are, where we've got our rural parts of the state that are literally feeding the world and fueling the world. And yet you're right, our smaller communities are having a tough go at it. We need to work with them to help diversify the economy. But as I looked at stuff, even as a county commissioner, when we were putting together allocations and things, you know, you almost have to have a base amount of funding for, you know, certain parts of our state so that we can ensure that those services are still being provided in those areas. And we need to take that into consideration. So it's extremely important that, you know, our Office of Economic Development would be working in our rural communities to assist. And again, it's to assist. It's not to dictate what's going on, but to assist. There are, you know, industries that are very well suited for rural Colorado and for, you know, outside of the Front Range. And those are the things that we need to be looking at and seeing how we can ensure that we do have a healthy Colorado the way around.
Yeah, and I guess that's where I was trying to drive is how do the dying places of Colorado, the small towns, and Alamosa is not dying by any means. Alamosa is doing really well. But I think of the counties around us, and I think of the southeastern plains and where I have friends and what I see there, and I see these really towns that aren't what they used to be in those days, right? And then I wonder, what's the responsibility of a governor to make sure each part of the state is healthy, or do you have that luxury? Do you need to focus on where the population centers are, which is really where the dollars get driven to?
I think a governor has responsibility to look at the entire state, first of all, and looking at how do we make sure that every portion of the state has opportunities for, you know, a great quality of life, but also a great workforce area. And it's like I was saying, so those that we know there are certain industries that are economic drivers for the state of Colorado. They're economic drivers for each of these communities. I mean, they're, you know, your communities were built around agriculture, and in some cases, the energy industry as well. And so we have a responsibility to work on that. But then there are other areas. And it's like I was talking before, even about healthcare, ensuring that our hospitals are strong in rural Colorado. Those are good workforce centers. And so is the higher education institutions, you know, the Adams States, Fort Lewis's.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and they bring the community together. And it's not just, as you're saying, it's not just the Alamosa community. It's the greater San Luis Valley community that relies on those economic drivers as well. And so I think as a governor and as a, you know, whether we're in state governor, even as a state senator, looking at the budget for the whole state of Colorado, we need to be looking at the whole state of Colorado and what we can do to assist and provide those resources. I will give you an example. Last year, and I knew this was coming because I'd been talking to some other folks, but our wastewater utility folks, so think sewer plants, right? In rural Colorado,
That's an issue.
The Department of Health was like going after them. And I'm like, you cannot shut them down. You can't expect them to do all of these things or otherwise, you know, they're serving maybe 1,000 people where, you know, you've got Denver Metro Waste who serves 2.3 million people. But it's like this small system is just as important as this large system. I mean, because if we don't have these capacities, these sewer capacities, wastewater treatment facility capacities, that community will die. Right. And so really worked with them and pushed on the health department and made some changes in law. But and it wasn't just, you know, I think it was the town manager of Akron, Colorado, who called me up and they're like, God, can you help us? Because, you know, they knew me from the Department of Local Affairs. And so this is where, you know, looking at what we have as far as grant opportunities, funding opportunities in the Department of Local Affairs, in the Department of Health, of Public Health and Environment, that we can work with these smaller communities to ensure that they have, you know, water and sewer provisions so that they can grow and that they can, or they can at least stay, you know, where they can remain healthy and have opportunities there.
I've heard a lot from Monta Vista, La Jara, other small towns on the challenges they have now trying to replace their sewage lagoons. I want to go, before we go back into issues, and we have several we're going to talk about, but before we go there, I just want to learn more about you. If I want to vote for you as governor, I'd like to know, you know, a little bit more about the people I'm thinking of voting for. So I want to just ask you to give us a little bit more of your upbringing, your biographical profile, if you were. Where'd you grow up, how you grew up,
sure,
who you grew up around, and who influenced you in those days?
So, well, first of all, I'm a mom of two daughters. And they both had three boys each. So that makes me a grandmother of six boys, which is like the best thing in the world. Just in case anybody wants to know, parenting is great, but grandparenting is so much better.
I would agree with that.
Right? So I am a fourth generation Coloradoan, lifelong Colorado, lived here my entire life. And I grew up on a dairy farm in North Jefferson County and grew up under pretty modest means. We didn't have a lot, you know. Most people probably would have considered us poor. I mean, I'll tell you a quick story. We actually had outdoor restroom facilities when I was very, very young. And I have six siblings, four brothers and two sisters. And so every night we'd have to go out and use the restroom before we'd go to bed. I mean, you know, my mom figured that one out. Nobody's getting up in the middle of the night kind of thing, right? And when we would go out there, I had an older brother. He was a little bit ornery and he would scare us. And my mom was a huge influence in my life. But my mom, this is how she thought about it. She didn't like yell at him and, you know, discipline him. She just said, look, if you're going to do that, you need to wait until they're coming back so that they're not, you know, we're not wetting our pants basically. And it was really pretty funny. But so I grew up in under a pretty modest situation. We didn't really have a lot of money, but we had a lot of family. My grandmother lived with us and my great uncle lived with us. So we had 11 people around the table. And I'm telling you, when they said, get to the table and eat, you got to the table or else you may not get anything to eat kind of thing. So, but it was a great lifestyle growing up on a farm. We all learned how to work. I spent 10 years in 4-H. When we turned 9 years of age, my father and mother allowed us to buy. They didn't give us. They allowed us to buy a heifer calf for $100. And my dad would go out in the herd and he knew which heifer calf we were getting because obviously he knew when we were turning nine. And so went through 10 years of 4-H. And if you didn't have the money to pay for your calf, my mom kept a ledger. And, you know, we had to do chores. My chores were to, and we got paid for them. So it wasn't like an allowance. We had to do chores. And my chores were to go out and feed the calves every morning and night. And, you know, when we had school, it was before school, and then it was after school. In the summer, it didn't matter. We all had chores to do. And on Saturdays, I had to clean the barn. And so I think that was really good practice, though, for what I do as a state senator when things I have to clean out, right? And, but so it was a great learning experience. We learned very good work ethic and just, you know, how to really pull together and do what you need to do, that it takes work and nobody gets off the hook. And we also, my parents were really very good about telling us, it doesn't matter how unfortunate you think you are, there's always somebody less fortunate than you, and you're supposed to be looking out for them. Hence why my grandmother lived with us and my great uncle lived with us, right? So it was instilled at me at a very young age that, you know, I'm here to help people and make things better. And that's what I think all of my siblings learned, that same lesson. So from there, I went and worked my way through college. I sold my herd, my small herd, and then I also worked my way through college. So,
for some reason, I was surprised you went to CU versus CSU.
Well, I actually went to CSU for 2 years, and then that was a little farther away from home. So I was able to, I went to University of Colorado, and that helped with the money situation because I was able to do some time at home there and save on rent and things of that nature, right? And so then I graduated from University of Colorado, but I did 2 years at CSU. So I, yes,
gotcha.
I do like
CSU.
So
you're a Ram and a Buffalo.
Yeah, I'm pretty solid go Buffs though. So, but you know, there's one day out of the year though, you know, I'm totally on the CU side, but other than that, you know, I'm for CSU too. But so I worked my way through college and got a degree in education, actually, in physical education. So I got a teaching degree and had a minor in English. And I did some student teaching, and get this, when I was doing my student teaching, I thought, wow, this is way too political. There's a lot of stuff that goes on in schools that I didn't realize, kind of stuff. And I ended up owning, after that, I went into business with my sister, and I owned a floral shop up in Fort Collins. And then when I got married, I ended up owning a dairy farm and running a dairy farm. So
very nice.
A lot of experience there.
Yeah, that's really nice to, interesting to hear that. And yeah. And you became, you're the longest serving county commissioner in Weld County.
Okay.
You served for quite a few years as a county commissioner, which I would think is good training ground to be a state legislator, to be a state senator, because county government, you know, that's what implements elections. That's what implements health and human services. That's what, right? County government. And they always talk about unfunded mandates from the state. And I've heard that for decades.
I've heard
unfunded
for over 30 years. Yeah.
Is that a thing still?
Oh, absolutely it is.
And why can't the legislature do something about that? Or why do those happen, unfunded mandates? Explain that.
I think part of it, unfunded mandates happen, I think partially because legislators, for the most part, don't really understand how the programs are implemented. And being a county commissioner is actually it's probably more similar to being governor than it is to being a state legislator. County commissioners are the only elected official, and it's one of the best positions as an elected official at this point. Of course, I haven't been governor yet, so. County commissioner wears all three hats of government, though, where, you know, county commissioners have a quasi-judicial, you know, responsibilities. They have so they have land use, and then they have legislative responsibilities, and then they are the executors and the administrators of the county, and they run the budget. And that's why I gravitated towards the budget as a state senator, you know, being on the Joint Budget Committee, because it kind of gets me back to my roots of being a county commissioner. But so there are unfunded mandates because there aren't very many county commissioners who are state legislators. I'm the only county commissioner former county commissioner on the Joint Budget Committee. And so you're right. I do know how programs are implemented, how all those human services programs are implemented, because they're implemented at the county level. Not everybody understands that, but, you know, at the state, I think they feel like state legislators, when I was a county commissioner, it was kind of like, well, you know, this is what the counties need to help pay for, and we can't afford all of it, so we're going to push unfunded mandates onto the counties, and that's what's happened.
As governor, you could not, though, stop unfunded mandates. You couldn't say, well, I'm governor now, and I don't want these unfunded mandates, these legislative bills, these laws that hit counties without dollars attached to them. You couldn't, as governor, say, hey, we're not going to do that anymore, right?
Well, I certainly could veto any new bills coming forward. I can also, governor can also veto, has line item veto in the budget, and you can stop spending. But here's the most important thing that I think the governor can do is, one, really work to instill trust and build partnerships. You know, I was just with a group of county commissioners, and we were talking about human services program, and I heard one of the county commissioners from my county, great friend of mine, who said, you know, well, we need to be better advocates. And I turned around, looked at him, and I said, you need to realize you're a partner. You are not an advocate. You are a partner in implementing these programs, and you need to be a stronger partner. And you need to demand that the state become a stronger partner as well. And so as governor, I can really instill that partnership mentality and how do we work together for the betterment of all the people in the state of Colorado. And I think that's the most important thing. And that's what it takes. And again, I'll just give you a quick example that happened just recently. It's in the Department of Human Services. They are looking at changing the whole temporary aid to needy families program, which is, it's called TANF, and it's a welfare program. And they're looking at to change all that. And instead of working with their partner in counties, they just like spring the idea on them and saying, oh, by the way, we're going to have this in place by July 1 of 2026. There's no way they're going to get that in place. But what they should have been doing is, for the last year, if they had this idea, they should have been sitting down and talking and working with the counties and developing those partnerships to come up with better resolutions, to come up with better solutions to how we solve some of these problems that we're facing, whether it's the unfunded mandates or the lack of funding for some of these programs because of the budget situation that the county or that the state is in.
I want to ask you about five areas that we see, all of us, no matter where we live. We see price increases in these five areas far exceeding the growth in household income. And I think these are areas we all relate to as Coloradans and just across the country. And I want to ask you about each of these areas. There's five of them: housing, food, healthcare, childcare, energy. And what I want to ask you to do is tell us, based on your work in the legislature, I mean, you know Colorado. You know the budget. You've been on the, you talked about the JBC, you've been on the education committee. I mean, you really are deep in the legislature.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us where Colorado is headed right now in these areas and how you would either change direction or continue forward in the direction we're moving. I'm going to start with housing.
Sure. So housing is one of those things over the course of the last few years, we have had the state legislature and the governor's office think that they should be determining essentially land use and local control and taking away local control. I am a local control person. I mean, I was a county commissioner for 20 years. We did a lot of land use, and we have a lot of land use authority in the local government area, and I think that's where it needs to be. I think it's the people who live in those communities who should define the character of their neighborhood, not a group of executive directors underneath the governor deciding in Denver what neighborhoods should look like. So that's the first thing.
I want to ask you about that because you hear about that, and I honestly am not that clear about what I'm hearing when I hear this. You have a governor now and you have legislation that values housing in a certain way in terms of density type developments versus what? Sprawl versus what? Yeah, local. That's what I don't know when, because I hear that here in Alamosa County. And I hear commissioners, I hear municipal city council say, the state of Colorado wants us to do this way. And I don't understand that. I don't understand what the state is asking when it comes to housing growth, how it grows. My understanding is it's density growth versus sprawl. I don't know. So that's why I want to clarify that to help help me understand
and
that. And then
so
where you want to go.
Sure. Absolutely. So from the governor's perspective and the Democrat-controlled majority in the legislature, the discussion really wasn't so much about sprawl versus density. It was about density, but it was really more focused on what's going on in the larger urban areas versus what's going on throughout the whole state. And at times, it was like they just totally, not dismissed, but just almost like ignored what was going on all over throughout the whole state, and it's important. But then they're trying to pass these laws that you're like, wait a minute, you know, that's not necessarily going to work everywhere. And I think the other thing that legislators and this governor and his governor's office don't understand is there's a lot that goes into developing a parcel, developing, you know, housing in a local government. You have to have the water infrastructure and the sewer infrastructure in place. You have to be able to have the water, which is extremely important, or you can't develop. And then there's, you know, you have to have a person who's willing to develop that wants to go through all these regulations. What has happened at the state is we've added on additional regulations. We've added on these building codes and these energy codes that drive up the cost of housing. And I think they learned this after the Marshall Fire, you know, which was up in Superior, near Boulder, up in that way in Boulder County. After those homes all burnt down, to rebuild their homes, it would have cost them the 30 to 40% more than what it did in the first place. And it's because of a lot of the regulation that was put in place by the legislative branch and the governor who signed off on those. So those are things that need to be switched. The other thing that is, again, going on, and I keep talking about this a lot because I'm talking about what the state can do versus what you do at the local government level. It truly is the local government level, the people who live in those communities that should be deciding what their community looks like, not 100 legislators. But what government, state government can do is look at our grant programs and kind of what we were talking about earlier is how do we assist communities in building out that infrastructure, whether it's their water infrastructure or their wastewater, their sewer infrastructure. And then one of the things that's disturbing that just happened in the last couple of days is the Public Utilities Commission just pushed through a decision that says, hey, by a certain date, I think it's 2035, somewhere in there, that our utility companies have to reduce their reliance on natural gas. They're trying to get us to zero natural gas in our system, which means we will have an unreliable, unsustainable system that will literally could leave us in the dark or leave us out in the cold kind of thing. And it's affecting everywhere. I mean, they're driving us towards electricity that comes from wind and solar power. And I'm not against wind and solar power, and it's fine, but it's intermittent energy that we would have. And, you know, making everybody go buy heat pumps and getting off their natural gas and not having natural gas heat or natural gas, you know, furnaces or stoves or things of that nature is just not practical for all of Colorado, and it will drive up the cost. So instead of the state figuring out how to lower costs and making, you know, energy and heat affordable, they're actually driving up those costs substantially. And in fact, in the last 5 years, our utility bills on average have gone up by about 38%. So it's things like that at the state, I mean, that the governor can help with, providing resources, working and partnering with local governments, not dictating to them that they have to have accessory dwelling units in their zoning, when most local governments already had that and they already have the opportunity to do that.
So it sounds like you would reverse course on housing in terms of what we're trying to do now as a state, or what the mandates are, or what the rules are for housing. Certainly. Today,
we need to reverse course on all of the additional regulations and things that have been put in place that are driving up the cost of housing.
Okay.
And that's what's going on. And then a vision as far as going through the future, though, with housing is we really need to, as a state and as a governor, we should be partnering with local government. And I will remind everybody of Governor Roy Romer, who was a Democrat, but he did the Smart Growth Initiative, and it was wonderful. I was a county commissioner then, and it was a really good initiative, and it is something that I would probably build upon. But he did this initiative where he brought local governments to the table, environmental groups, home builders, you know, financiers, everybody got to come to the table and talk about what does Colorado look like in the next 20 to 50 years? And then how do we get there? And that's how you do it, is by building those partnerships and working with folks.
Roy Romer, the last rural governor of Colorado, grew up from Holly.
Yeah.
I want to just clarify really quick, because I make sure the natural gas issue that you brought up, the way I understand, I have natural gas. We have a gas stove. We prefer natural gas. We prefer natural gas. My wife does when she's cooking, so we have a natural gas stove. Put that in when we remodeled our kitchen not long ago. But my understanding of the natural gas rules the Colorado Public Commission, et cetera, wants is, or has, is I don't have to take my natural gas stove out. The state of Colorado is not going to tell me, Chris, you got to take your natural, because I would say, no, I'm not going to do that, right? You're not going to tell me, Chris, you got to take your natural gas stove out, because Chris is going to say, oh, go away, because I'm not going to do that. You're just talking about new thing, new developments.
That would be the first thing is new developments. But what they have done is put a additional pressure on, the Excels and the Atmoses and the Tri-States and the Black Hills energy folks who provide, the basis for energy for all of our rural co-ops, and told them that they have to get to a certain percentage. I mean, we have to be totally decarbonized by 2051, but then they moved that up and said, we need to now have another 41% cut. And I think it's by 2035. So a 41% cut. So you're going to have all of these folks who are saying, look, you've got to start going towards heat pumps, which don't work in Colorado because of our extreme temperatures here, and pushing you that way. So eventually, yes, it could mean that you have to replace your gas stoves and your gas furnaces. But to begin with, you're correct. You don't have to go out and take those out right now. But eventually this will end up, and what happens is it's the ratepayer who ends up paying the additional costs.
And again, because people hear natural gas and they do hear, oh, the state of Colorado is going to require me to get off natural. The other issue that came up on that or comes up on that, again, and you tell me if I'm wrong, propane. This is not affecting people that live on propane or use propane, because in this part of the country, in this part of the state, mm-hmm. There's a lot of people on propane.
We're not
eliminating propane as part of this rule either, right?
No, not at this point, no. Okay. But what we are eliminating, though, or what is happening is putting additional pressures and more regulatory burden on the providers of electricity. Because even if you have propane, you're still paying an electrical bill, right? And you have a utility bill. And so they're putting additional pressure on the people who are providing the electricity to basically go totally away from natural gas. And it was supposed to be by 2050, and now they're moving that year up essentially by requiring a 41% reduction rather than later.
Do you believe are the figures accurate that we have a housing shortage in the state of Colorado? We call it a housing shortage. Do we have that? Is that the case? Or is it a combination of things that has created this pressure on housing? When I say combination of things, I think of the Airbnb homes and the movement to take private properties and turn them into rentals, mm-hmm. and things like that. Mm-hmm. That's what I wonder when I think of the housing mix.
I think we have a shortage of attainable housing.
Okay, I'm going to move on to energy. Since we're talking Excel, we're talking natural gas, let's talk energy. Mm-hmm. And another area where we just see price increases outstripping our ability, our income growth. I just got a message from Excel that my energy bill is going to go up again, coming up, because they just got another rate through Public Utilities Commission. Mm-hmm. So I'm expecting another hike through Excel Energy. What's the governor's ability to work in this space with the Colorado Public Utilities Commission, energy providers like Excel? Because it honestly feels like as a consumer, you're just at their mercy. You take it, you ain't got much choice. And I don't know if there's, again, any movement there for a governor, mm-hmm. to affect any of this. And then I want you also to address the power grid in the state of Colorado.
So there is a way for the governor to affect all of this. The governor appoints the members of the Public Utilities Commission, and then they're the ones who make the decision. But he has the ability to appoint them and also instill in, what his vision is or his mission is with regard for the state of Colorado. So that's the most important thing. In fact, I think it's probably one of the most important things that a governor can do. He has control over all the boards and commissions and the appointments. And he's been making a lot of changes over the course of the last 7 years. So the first thing that can happen is the new rule that was just passed, or not the new approval that was just passed, that requires the Excels and the Black Hills Energy and all of them that are providing electricity to, us throughout the state of Colorado. That's what the new approval was, is that you have to get to, it's called a clean heat plan. Mm-hmm. And it was supposed to be this decarbonization by 2050. So, no more fossil fuels, essentially, is what they were trying to say by 2050. And they just kind of like accelerated that. And it will increase rates again. And, on behalf of Excel or Black Hills Energy, we passed laws. Laws were passed in 2019. I wasn't a state senator. I was as a county commissioner then. I wasn't a state senator then. But laws were passed then that started requiring this move to decarbonization and a move away from fossil fuels. So a move away from natural gas, which is clean, affordable, sustainable, and reliable, right? And a move away from that. So your rates will probably go up again, because now what happens is they have to think of all of the natural gas infrastructure that is in place in the state that has to be replaced. It has to now be more reliable on wind and solar. So they've got to put that infrastructure in place, and that will affect the grid and how long it takes. And it's going to affect your rates because of how much it's going to cost to make those changes that Xcel is going to have to make. So part of it, I mean, I get when people say, you know, Xcel's maybe taking money off the top or whatever, and their executives are making a heck of a lot of money. But at the same time, since 2019, there was another law that was passed in 2021 that created this clean heat plan requirement that they had, that the Xcels of the world, Atmos Energy, all of them have to do this planning, right? There has been another 73 bills passed that have affected the regulation on utilities.
So what's the solution here? As governor, you're in the governor's house. What's the solution here in this area of ongoing rate hikes? Not really a lot of control on utilities in terms of, yeah, we have the Public Utilities Commission, but it just feels like they hear it, they let us comment, but they still pass it through. There's not a lot of pushback, it doesn't feel like. And I don't know if there are solutions.
Well, I think the solution is to ease back on the regulatory burdens of all the, you know, all this red tape that we have been throwing on to, people who are out there, the Xcels and the Atmoses and the, you know, the Black Hills Energy and all of them, the additional, I mean, think about it, in the course of 7 years, 75 bills that are regulating this industry, all that does is increase rates. And, you know, we all talk about all of the above energy, you know, but at some point, from my perspective, we need to start talking about what is the best of the above. We can do all of the above, but shouldn't we be going to the best of the above? And, trying to get totally away from fossil fuels when it's been proven that, you know, natural gas is clean, it is affordable, and it's reliable. And that's what the people of the state of Colorado deserve. We deserve energy sources that are reliable, affordable, sustainable, and that, you know, we would have them in place. Instead of this, I think it's almost like a false narrative that is pushed by special interest groups that say, oh no, you know, we've got to do all this to cut greenhouse gases. Well, we have cut greenhouse gases pretty much as we can in this state. I mean, I'm not saying there aren't more things we can do and we should be doing. We all want clean air. We all want clean water. But at the same time, we all want heat in our homes as well.
We were joking the other day in here that we were talking about the proposed merger with Netflix and Warner Brothers Discovery and what that's going to do to streaming services. And then we said, well, we won't be able to afford streaming services, but that's all right, because we won't be able to turn on the TV because our power is going to be too high. So we're going to revert back to just reading by candlelight books at night.
Yeah.
Because we can't afford the TV and the streaming services, and we won't be able to afford the power anyway, so we're just going back to candles. That's what Owen and I said we're going to do.
So we've got to take a really comprehensive look at all of the regulations that have been passed and then start repealing those or clawing some of those back.
But I want to ask about, because for the Valley, this is probably one of the top two issues for us, and that is the bottleneck of the grid, of the power transmission in and out of the San Luis Valley. The Alamosa County Commissioners gave early approval. They're going to take it up in 2026, but there's a 680 megawatt solar power plant and a 680 megawatt solar storage facility that they want to build here. That is massive amount of solar, 600. We could not push that out. The state of Colorado couldn't benefit from that because the grid, the transmission is not there to do that. So we have to solve that issue. Mm-hmm. That's been an issue that's been going on for decades, unable to get anyone's, it seems, attention. I don't know if you've heard about that or what you think about that.
I've heard a little bit about it, but not a lot. I mean, because it's a situation that's occurring in other parts of the state as well, with the lack of transmission lines and the grid power. And, you know, it goes down to even like when we were having broadband access issues, right, throughout the state of Colorado, and we had to develop the multi-use network system throughout the state, which still I'm not sure that we have broadband access everywhere as it is. But it comes down to cost and revenues, like, and the expenditures and revenues, and is there a good return on investment? And I think that's where maybe at some point the state does need to look at how do we step in, how do we assist? Are there grants and things that we could do? Are there, you know, funding at the federal government level that we could do to extend the grid, extend those transmission lines? And then again, working with local governments on their land use proposals and making sure that we are taking a comprehensive look. And I think that's where, again, it's about partnerships, working together and seeing how we do bring those resources into areas like the Valley or other areas of the state, quite frankly.
The lack of transmission capacity in the San Luis Valley is the top issue here, one of the top two issues. Just want to note that for you. I want to move on to healthcare, because you've talked about and you touched on particularly rural healthcare. And we know here in the San Luis Valley, our economy relies on San Luis Valley Medical Health, relies on valley-wide health systems. We have two big health systems here in the Valley that really do drive the economy. So I think that's a really important issue for us. But I honestly don't understand why the structural problems Colorado has with its budget when it comes to Medicaid reimbursements, Medicaid costs, and just health care, because I know that seems to be a big sucker on that budget, or a big structural problem for the budget. At least that's what I hear. I want you to explain Medicaid, explain health care for us, and where we're going now.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me back up first a little bit with regard to the state's budget. Back in March of 2021, I wasn't on the Joint Budget Committee at that point, but they knew at that point we had what's called a structural deficit, where our spending was outpacing our revenues by a lot. And what happened at that time, obviously, it was right around COVID, and we were getting a lot of federal dollars, you know, COVID dollars, American Rescue Plan dollars, and I'm talking in the billions.
Yeah.
And we used those dollars to create new programs and new offices and hire new employees. Instead of one-time expenditures, they've turned into ongoing expenditures. And it's put our budget in a situation where, you know, even in 24, when I was on the Joint Budget Committee, I was like, look, we need to start cutting our spending.
Give us a little bit, because what you said there, I have not heard anyone say that before.
Really?
To say that how we were spending those federal COVID dollars, we all knew COVID dollars were flowing in. We knew American Rescue dollars, and the cities did it too here.
And the counties, yeah.
But I didn't take it to the point where we created new programs out of it that we now can no longer sustain or maintain because of our income situation. That's... Give me a little bit more around that specifics, if you can.
Yeah. So I know in Weld County, because I was county commissioner during that time, we actually did spend the money on like one-time type things, improving, you know, different areas. And we didn't create new programs because if you don't have for sure ongoing money, you shouldn't be creating new programs and things of that nature. But there, I mean, and it was just as much on the legislative branch as the executive branch. I mean, they were working together, this one-party control and Democrat majority, and creating new programs. We created the new Department of Early Childhood. And, you know, we're spending double the amount of money, but we don't have double the amount of kids in preschool kind of thing. We created the Behavioral Health Administration. And, you know, we were just looking at that in the budget the other day thinking, wow, we've got all of these disparate kind of siloed projects and programs, new bills that were passed in the last 4 or 5 years that are in like across like, I want to say like maybe 13 or 14 different departments.
So
they're all siloed out. And so instead of really looking at how our funds should be spent and creating programs that, you know, instead of creating programs that need ongoing funding, we should have been boosting and doing things that were like capital improvements and things of that nature, you know, in our healthcare system and everywhere, quite frankly, that we were using it and everywhere through State Department. But what happened was, is again, we were spending quite frankly like we were going to always get that money, and we knew we weren't, and that was a problem. The other thing that happened was with the Medicaid funding. So Medicaid is basically government health insurance, I think, as most people understand. During the COVID era, if you were eligible for Medicaid, you stayed on. There was no reassessment done, and it didn't matter what your your eligibility criteria, your income levels were, it just, you stayed on. So at one point, one in every three Coloradoans was on Medicaid during that time frame. Now we're down to about 22%, so less than one in four, right? Which is where we were pre-COVID. Mm-hmm. But during that time frame, I mean, we spent a lot of money there and building up healthcare systems and things and putting money into to staff and whatever. And but it's money that we don't have now because those people are no longer on Medicaid because they were determined eligible. So we're back down to where we were pre-COVID time frame with the number of people on Medicaid. But utilization really increased a lot as well with Medicaid. But also what happened during that time frame, even though, and I don't know for sure what happened in 22 and 21 because I wasn't on the Joint Budget Committee, but in 23, inflation was over 8%. But we increased the provider rates, so reimbursements to hospitals and doctors for, you know, providing healthcare services. Inflation was at over 8%. I had to fight to get the provider rates increased up to 3%. So even then, we were undercutting and not funding enough to the hospitals to provide for healthcare in our state. That was in 23. In 24, we were at over 5% inflation, and I think we did a 2% increase in the provider rates, right? This last year, I was able to get us up to 1.6% increase when we had 2.4% inflation. And then what happened after the special session is the governor came in and just cut the percentage increase down to zero. And now in his budget request, he's cutting $500 million out of Medicaid funding. And everybody, and you know, I explained this on a radio show just a couple of weeks ago, because it's like, what? Why is it the conservative, fiscally conservative Republican is the one that's arguing to get the provider rates up? And as I explained to them, if there is a healthcare desert in a county, whichever county it is, it's not just impacting Medicaid folks, it's impacting everyone in that county. And so what has happened is, because like with maternal health care, it's very expensive. And if you have maternal health care, you have to provide it as a hospital to everyone. Well, their payer mix is such that more of their people that are coming in are less commercial payers and more on Medicaid. So if you're getting 30 or 40 cents on the dollar for the Medicaid services, for the healthcare services that you're providing, because they have Medicaid insurance versus commercial insurance, and most of your payer mix is government insurance, whether it's Medicaid or Medicare, and you're constantly not getting paid enough for that service, you go out of business. And that's what's happening. So hospitals have closed their maternal health care centers. And so we need to, I know myself and Senator Mullica, who's Democrat out of Thornton area, we passed a bill last year that we called Save Our Safety Net. And it was just to stabilize our safety net, because our clinics like the Saludes and the Sunrises and other clinics throughout the state, we're also laying people off and closing certain services and not able to provide those services. So we're trying to work with hospitals and clinics to figure out what do we need to do. And that's from the legislative branch. But as a governor, sorry, I just hit the microphone there. But as a governor, the governor should be taking the lead on that. And he's not. On what he's doing is just continually to cut Medicaid and not setting it as a priority in our budget. That's what needs to happen.
Yeah, but what I don't think, just like energy, just like we talked about, as a consumer, as a household, as a resident of Colorado, you don't have a lot of control over what you're going to pay, and they just shove it down you. Healthcare is the same way. Healthcare premiums, we don't have much. I mean, the government does these dances. Mm-hmm. The consumer just is there watching, and then we take whatever comes our way. We have to pay it. We have no choices, mm-hmm. really. I don't see how healthcare premiums ever stabilize, ever go down, and I don't understand, honestly, why we all just don't have the same healthcare. I just don't understand that. I don't know why whatever healthcare you get as a state legislator, why don't I just get that too? And I will say that I'm on Medicaid. I'm on, as a small business owner.
Sure.
We can't afford healthcare. We can't afford healthcare for any of our employees, right? So we deal with the system. We get whatever the system's going to give us, we're grateful for. We just got to deal with it. And I think that's kind of where Coloradoans are. We just take whatever comes our way, and we don't have much fight in this, and we don't have many solutions. It just keeps coming, and we just deal with it and move on.
Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of it, there's things that happen at the federal level that impacts, you know, our insurance rates. But here's some of the other things that have impacted our insurance rates is we've added mandates, if you will, and expanded what insurance has to cover. And that increased rates. Every time we start a new program, we add additional fee, you know, to the insurance premium and say, well, you know, we're not going to increase taxes, but then we increase a fee and it increases the premiums on insurance. And that impacts everybody, whether you're on Medicaid or not. And it starts impacting everybody about how do we afford insurance. And I think those are things that I know the insurance companies have said, look, could you just stop adding on? Could you just stop over-regulating us and doing these things to us? I mean, there's no such thing as free, right, in government. Somebody's paying for it someplace. Right.
If we reduce some of the regulations, reduce some of the red tape that Colorado's put in place under your administration as government, if we reduce some of those regulations, mm-hmm. are you saying that that translates into lower costs?
It should. But I can't guarantee that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, honestly, Chris, I'm not an expert on insurance either.
Yeah.
It's one of those things.
It's a tough one, right?
It is. It's extremely tough. And, you know, I probably shouldn't admit this, but it's one of those things where, you know, you're sitting there talking to, like I talk to the lobbyists for the insurance companies and I get everything they're saying. I understand everything they're saying. And then we walk out of the room and I think, now what am I supposed to go do? But, you know, I mean, it's very complicated.
Yeah, it is.
But I do know that the additional regulations and the additional burdens and the additional requirements of things, you know, things that insurance companies have to insure now that they didn't have to do before has increased the premium costs as well.
And we hear a lot, you know, we talked earlier about housing. We've heard a lot about regulations, heard a lot about complaints here locally from builders, from people trying to, we hear that. We know that those are concerns of individuals when you hear about regulations that they have to jump through. I want to move to childcare because that's another one, right? That people are struggling to figure out, how do I go to my job and have child care that I can afford?
And trust.
Mm-hmm. Or I'm better off just staying home and not working because it's cheaper in the long run, right? It's cheaper at the end of the day.
In some cases, it is. And I think, again, I don't have all the answers for what we do with regard to child care. You know, I know how it works within the human services programs because there's the federal grant program with regard to child care. But we set up this whole new department called the Department of Early Child Education. Childhood Education, right? I have to sit there and think of the acronym to think what it is. But
there was a big push to get people enrolled, get kids in there, get families enrolled in it, right?
And it's just been, in my estimate, it's just been mismanaged. Here's what happened. When we had the Colorado preschool program, we had approximately about 36,000 kids that were enrolled in the Colorado preschool program, and that was just in the public school system, right? And then the ballot initiative passed that said, hey, you know, we increased this tax, y'all get an additional 10 hours. And, you know, and it wasn't a tax on everybody, so people vote for it. And it's like, hey, it's a great thing. And so you're supposed to get an additional, you know, be able to pay for like 10 hours of childcare or 10 hours of preschool, you know. And so it's like, okay, well, that should be a really good idea and it shouldn't be that hard to do. But the program has morphed into where we have doubled the price. So where we were spending like $175 million on the Colorado preschool program, we now spend over $350 million on this new early preschool program that we have in place. And we haven't doubled the number of children in it. And it's been difficult for parents to get their kids into a facility that's close for them or a facility that works for them. Maybe it's close to their home. Maybe it's close to where they work. It was supposed to be that additional 10 hours. The public schools, they sued the governor over this. I've never heard that happen. And when I talked to the governor and said, could you just like sit down with them? Could we get this figure out and stop the lawsuit? And he's like, well, no, we're going to win. I'm like, that's not a good reason. Like everybody should be working together here. Nobody is served by these lawsuits, right? That's not good. But we had school districts who sued the governor. We have childcare facilities who are closing. They've closed slots. They've closed, you know, seats for kids. And it's like, okay, it's not working. And it's been 3 years now. almost 4 years now, and they're not willing to make any changes. And so as governor, it's one of those areas that I think I could go in and we could manage it better and we could do a better job. Is it going to solve the whole solution, the whole problem? But no, but we could get back to like what was promised in that ballot initiative where, you know, regardless of where you were going before, we could get you an extra 10 hours. And quite frankly, I know from my perspective, being a mom, my grandchildren now, my kids are older, but not that I need to have a child in childcare.
Well, there are a lot of grandmas though that are raising.
Yeah.
Grandkids.
Yeah. And I would help out, you know, wherever I could kind of thing, especially like in the summer and that kind of stuff when I'm not in session. But, you know, I know like when I was thinking about this ballot initiative, I'm thinking, okay, if my kids are enrolled in public preschool and I'm going to get another 10 hours, that's really going to help me out because my kids maybe were getting out around 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And now I'm going to have 5 days of where I could get that other 2 hours in a childcare facility someplace. And that didn't really happen. That kind of thinking just didn't happen. So at some point we said, I need to start interjecting some common sense back into government and treating it the same way that people treat their own pocketbooks, right?
I guess the question on that when you think about this mm-hmm. is you're in the governor's office, but you also probably still have a strong Democratic legislature.
Yes.
Who wants certain things, who wants to keep moving in certain, how do you balance, how do you work there?
So I've worked very well across the aisle as a state senator. I mean, I'm in the minority. All my bills, with the exception of one, have been bipartisan. Because they have to be. That's the only way I can get anything done.
So you think you have a good enough reputation with Democratic lawmakers that you would be able to work with them?
Absolutely. I think because I have worked with them. I mean, I've carried bills to, like I said, to stabilize the safety net, the healthcare safety net. That was last year with Senator Mullica, Democrat. Carried bills with Senator Zenzinger, another former Democrat legislator. She's now a county commissioner in Jefferson County. Carried bills with her to get additional education funding and to eliminate the budget stabilization factor. So been able to do that. Then in 2024, carried bills with Senator Hansen, Democrat out of Denver. Both bills, I mean, and I was prime sponsor, so very engaged, engaged in the negotiations of these bills, but carried two bills on the decreasing property taxes. So it was not once, but twice, the largest property tax cut in the state of Colorado. So my first year as a state senator, knowing I was in the minority, you know, I sat there and observed the other side of the aisle, and thought, you know, who can I work with over there and to get stuff done? Because that's my job. That's what I'm supposed to be doing. And that's why I run for office in the first place. I don't want to just sit there and be a person who votes no on everything and tries to obstruct government. That's not what I'm doing. So I developed some really good working relationships with folks. And in my committees, I was on the Education Committee, the Local Government Committee, and the Health and Human Services Committee. So three committees that I was on. And then also the Statutory Revision Committee. I was on these committees. You know, I specifically looked and worked and said, how do we work together? There are things, probably 80% of the time that we're going to agree on. Let's go focus on those and go do good things for the state of Colorado. And I believe as a state senator, as a county commissioner, I have delivered, you know, for the state of Colorado in so many ways.
I want to finish by talking a little bit about food, about talking a little bit about Colorado ag and what we're seeing there when it comes to prices at the grocery store, when it comes to productivity in our agricultural fields. We know here in the San Luis Valley that we're the fastest drying region in the state of Colorado. We're losing acres every year, irrigation acres, because we have to reduce our consumption of water. We can't grow as much, and we're not going to be able to continue to grow as much. Where's Colorado from your perspective when it comes to agriculture? How healthy is it? We have big challenges, particularly here, that I know of when it comes to water and how that affects what we're able to do in the agricultural fields.
What's happening in the San Luis Valley is happening throughout the entire state. I mean, I know the other areas of the state aren't necessarily drying as quickly as the San Luis Valley is what you've indicated, but there is still the drying up of the water resources within the state. And it's happening just along the Front Range. I mean, Weld County, where I was a county commissioner, and, you know, like I said, I grew up on a dairy farm, didn't own a dairy farm, but Weld County is the number one agricultural county, and we have an extensive irrigation system. And I know you do in the valley as well. And it's the pressure from the urban areas to basically pull that water away from agriculture to use it for residential development. And it's probably one of it's a huge stumbling block for, you know, water, for residential development and for affordable housing. And again, I don't think people understand that how expensive water is in our state and how precious it is in our state. So there does need to be conservation methods that are in place, and they are, you know, along the Front Range and in areas. But just saying that even with those conservation measures, they're not doing enough in those urbanized areas, and they're trying to basically come up. I mean, in my neck of the woods, they came up and flat out purchased the water from folks, and right. then they're switching right. it over. And I know that's a problem here as well, or, you know, a scare here as well. I think there needs to be a balance. There's got to be a way, you know, the consumptive use and the right of use, and use that, you know, through an agricultural system as well, and then be able to use that through also the urban areas as well, and figure that out. There's got to be ways to do that. I know different developments that have occurred both in Weld County and Douglas County that have really looked at how do we make this shift in water? How do we allow, you know, agriculture water to exist, but at the same time be able to reuse that, you know, because agriculture water is reused like 7 different times, right, as it goes through the system, and you can't interrupt that system. And so I think as developers are coming online, they're looking at, well, how do we play into that? How do we keep making that work so that we aren't drying up our aquifers throughout the state of Colorado? Because they're important everywhere. And then the other issue too is, again, I don't think most people understand that water rights are a private property right. And people do have the right to sell their water, and it's not necessarily governed by the state of Colorado, but there is a lot of water court that goes on, but it's a water right, and we need to respect that as well, and make sure that we aren't getting in the way of infringing on that water right. One of the bills that I carried in 2 sessions ago was the dredge and fill bill, and it had to do with the Sackett decision and EPA.
Yeah.
And now here I am now fighting with the health department on their rulemaking because
on
they're
wetlands,
going too far.
On the rivers and the wetlands.
On the rivers and the wetlands. And the bill was a negotiated deal. I was the only Republican on the bill, and it was 3 Democrats. One of those was the Speaker of the House, and then Senator Roberts from Eagle County up that way. Anyways, we negotiated a deal to, one, protect water rights. We exempted out agriculture, you know, because the ditches and, you know, we have water that's running in the borrow pits, but it's agriculture water, it's irrigation water, and those types of things. So we exempted that out, and in their rulemaking just recently, now they're trying to figure out how to add it back in, you know, make it like a water of the state kind of thing. That's a problem. And that, again, is where the governor should be stepping in and saying, hey, no, we're not going to go and extend farther than what the EPA is doing, and we're not going to redefine the law through a regulation and a rule. And that's where the governor could step in and help.
You know, when I think of the future 2026 and beyond, and the next governor of Colorado, whoever that is going to be, it could be you, Barb Kirkmeyer. When I think of that, though, Colorado River Basin, the Rio Grande Compact, the Rio Grande Basin,
the Platte River, the Republican water,
I would imagine, is going to be a major topic for the next governor to try to solve. Not by itself, but with other states in these interstate compacts. It's going to be a fascinating period of time how we deal with our water rights situations.
I think you're right. I think it's going to be about water. It's about our healthcare infrastructure system. How do we ensure that we have a strong healthcare system throughout the entire state of Colorado? I think roads are becoming a big issue again as well. When I'm out talking to folks throughout the state of Colorado, it doesn't matter where I go, whether it's in Jefferson County or, you know, in Mesa County or Weld County or Adams County. It doesn't matter. Even here, I mean, as you go out east on 76 or you go out east on I-70, people are just like, really upset over their roads. And I think that will be an issue as well. But I think in the future, you're exactly right. It's going to be about healthcare infrastructure system. It's going to be about our water. How do we protect our water resources? How do we ensure that we have water both for agriculture, which again, $47 billion industry in this state, And then also, how do we have water for growth and development throughout the state? So how do we make it work together? And that takes a governor that is literally knows how to govern and has been a leader and has delivered for the state of Colorado, which I believe I have. And but we have to figure out how to lead our way out of this mess. And you don't do that alone. You've got to be able to develop partnerships, and you have to have people trust you. And the thing is, with this governor, the way he has handled the wolf introduction, farmers and ranchers don't trust this governor at this point. And that's why I talked about the divide being separated, you know, being wider than it was before this administration came into play. And we've got to get back to the place where farmers and ranchers, you know, who likes to hear about meat out days when we have such a huge industry in this state? I mean, there's a lot of cattle ranching down here in the valley, right? And so it's extremely important that we have a governor who knows how to lead, but not only knows how to lead, but can work in partnership with people and build that trust back. And I believe my resume, my experiences set me up to be the one that can do that best.
You do. You have quite the interesting government resume, interesting resume at the county level, at the state level. You've been in a lot of political conversations, a lot of legislative conversations, no doubt about that. We could keep talking. We could talk forever, but for the sake of time, we're going to wrap this one up. Hopefully we'll see you again.
I loved it. Thank you so much for having me. And hopefully we do see you. I see you again. This was great. And I just, again, want to thank you for what you're doing. Keeping people engaged and getting the information out to folks is just as important as everything that I'm doing as well. People need to know what is happening, not just in the valley, but throughout the state. And you've been great about getting that information disseminated. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for coming by. Hey, you've been listening to the Valley Pod in our episode with Colorado State Senator Barb Kirkmeyer, the Colorado primaries are June 30th, 2026. That's my 65th birthday. Pretty cool. June 30th, 2026. The Valley Pod is produced by Owen Woods, part of the AlamosaCitizen.com podcast lineup. See you around the valley.
All right. Thank you so much.
It's been a tough year for many folks in Monta Vista. As the holidays approach, a lot of us are feeling tired or anxious, but good things are still happening all around us. This year alone, the Lohr Foundation has partnered with your friends and neighbors to bring more than 75 community-driven projects to life, making things a little brighter here at home. Lohr funds ideas designed and led by Monta Vista locals of all ages, no nonprofit experience required. Whether it's helping neighbors save time or money, supporting families, or creating something that brings people together, your ideas can make a real impact. All it takes to get started is a simple conversation. And once your idea is approved, most projects receive funding within 30 days. So let's close out the year stronger together. Visit lohrfoundation.org or email yvette@lohrfoundation.org to learn more.
Hi, I'm Marty Jones, host of the Outdoor Citizen podcast. Join us every other Wednesday as we talk to outdoor enthusiasts, wildlife experts, recreationists, lovers of the outdoors, and people who spend their days and their lives outside. On the Outdoor Citizen, we talk all things outside and outdoors, provide you with the latest data and measurements for water and weather, give you upcoming outdoor events, and keep you up to date on the latest news. The Outdoor Citizen is brought to you by the AlamosaCitizen.com podcast lineup. You can listen wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time, enjoy the out of doors.